Douglas.
It's been a real pleasure talking with both of you. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today. If you've appreciated the show, please share it on WRT's online archive or wherever you find your podcasts. I'm your host, Douglas Haynes. I'd like to thank today's engineer, Andrew Thomas, producer Sarah Gabler, news director Shali Pittman, and receptionist Amy Lutsky. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today on A Public Affair here at WRT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned for Madison Book Beat. Yeah.
Pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen
and support. BBC News with Sue Montgomery. It's now thought that at least 6,000 Syrians have crossed into neighbouring Lebanon in the last few days to escape violence in the coastal provinces of Latakia and Tartus. The area is a stronghold of the ousted former president Bashar al-Assad, and hundreds of civilians were killed there by the new government's security forces. The BBC's Karin Torbay has been speaking to refugees in a border village.
They told us they came without any belongings, in fear for their safety, for their security. They heard about what was happening around them. A lot of stories were circulating. Some of them experienced firsthand some of the events that were happening in Syria. Others heard about them and were very afraid, so they had to flee. They told us they think that they are at the moment being targeted because of their religious identity, because they are Alawites.
The Trump administration has confirmed that it's cutting the vast majority of overseas aid programs run by USAID. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said a review had called for a cut of 83%. Nomi Iqbal reports from Washington.
In a social media post, Marco Rubio said USAID's more than 5,000 contracts spent tens of billions of dollars in ways that did not serve America and in some cases were harmful. He did not provide any details. Mr. Rubio said all remaining programs would be folded into the State Department. USAID provides billions of dollars globally to alleviate poverty, treat diseases, and respond to famines and natural disasters. Former officials for the agency said the dramatic cuts could lead to destabilization and threats to national security.
President Zelensky of Ukraine has arrived in Saudi Arabia, ahead of talks between the US and Ukraine that could lead to a peace deal with Russia. Mr. Zelensky will not directly participate in Tuesday's negotiations with senior US officials, but stressed Kyiv's commitment to peace. The US Secretary of State expressed optimism about the talks. Canada's most populous province has imposed a 25% surcharge on electricity exports to the United States in response to tariffs imposed by Washington. The surcharge was announced by the Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford.
For the 1.5 million American homes and businesses that Ontario powers, this surcharge will cost families and businesses up to $400,000 each and every single day. Let me be clear, I will not hesitate to increase this charge. If necessary, if the United States escalates, I will not hesitate to shut the electricity off completely.
BBC News. Stock markets in the United States have fallen sharply in early trading as investors worry about the US economy and the impact of President Trump's tariffs. The losses came after Mr. Trump refused to rule out the possibility of a recession in an interview with Fox News broadcast on Sunday. A major rescue operation is continuing off the east coast of England after an American and a Portuguese ship collided in the North Sea. The American tanker was carrying aviation fuel, the other vessel sodium cyanide. This announcement came from the Coast Guard immediately after the accident.
So Long has collided with tanker Stena Immaculate.
in the outer anchorage. Both vessels are abandoning. Vessels who have firefighting equipment or who can assist with search and rescue, contact Humber Coast Guard on Channel 16. Vessel Stena Immaculate is carrying Jet A1 fuel, which is on fire and in the water.
More than 30 casualties have been brought ashore. The head of the UN's Relief Agency for Palestinians has warned that a hunger crisis could return to Gaza if Israel keeps preventing aid deliveries. Speaking in Geneva, Philippe Lazzarini said blocking basic assistance to achieve political and military goals was against international norms. Israel stopped aid at the beginning of the month, accusing Hamas of rejecting a US proposal to extend the Gaza ceasefire. It also cut off electricity over the weekend. Police in Greece have briefly detained a far-right member of parliament who attacked artworks in the National Gallery that he considered sacrilegious. Nikolaos Papadopoulos broke the protective glass of several paintings and removed them from the wall. Writing on X, he said the pieces he attacked were blasphemous to the Virgin Mary. BBC News.
Do you care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
Hello, and welcome to Madison Bookbeat, your home for Madison authors and authors coming to town. I'm your host, Sarah Batke, and I'm your host every second Monday of the month. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today author Christine Wentz to talk about her new book, Funny Because It's True. In 1988, a band of University of Wisconsin-Madison undergrads and dropouts began publishing a free weekly newspaper with no editorial stance other than, "You are dumb." Just wanting to make a few bucks, they wound up becoming the bedrock of modern satire over the course of 20 years, changing the way we consume both our comedy and our news. The Onion served as a hilarious and brutally perceptive satire of the absurdity and horrors of late 20th century American life and grew into a global phenomenon. Now, for the first time, the full history of the publication is told by one of its original staffers, author and historian Christine Wentz. Through dozens of interviews, Wentz charts The Onion's rise, its position as one of the first online humor sites, and the way it influenced television programs like The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. Funny Because It's True reveals how a group of young misfits from flyover country unintentionally created a cultural phenomenon. Christine Wentz was a member of The Onion's original staff from 1988 to 1990 as a UW-Madison undergrad. She has played central roles in highly regarded public history projects for Harvard University Libraries, Brigham and Women's Hospital, and the National Library of Medicine, and has received writing grants from the Awesome Foundation and the National Endowment for the Humanities. She is also trained in Midwestern prairie ecosystem restoration and likes to spend time helping to revitalize one of the rarest, most diverse, most beautiful, and most ecologically beneficial landscapes on the planet. She grew up in rural Spring Green, Wisconsin. Christine, thank you so much for joining me and congratulations on the book.
Thanks so much, Sarah. I'm really excited to be here.
good. So this is a bit of a homecoming for you. You hosted a late night music show on Wart when you were a student at UW. So
I did.
How does it feel to be back?
It feels great to be back. Yeah, I was trying to figure out which studio I used to be in. And I can't quite figure it out. I might have to wander around later, but yeah.
Yeah, well, we're happy to have you back again. So I think maybe just to get started, you could read a little excerpt from the book to sort of set the tone for us.
Sure. So the book tells the story of the people who made The Onion, but I also place the story of The Onion deeper in the history of media and the news since the late 80s, since, as we all know, there's been some pretty significant changes. So this book is sort of a stealth history of the news media since the late 80s also, told through the lens of The Onion, since The Onion had to satirize it. So I figured I better learn, you know, that story if I'm going to learn about the people who satirized the story. So anyway, this excerpt that I'll read is a few pages from chapter 9, and it's probably around 1997 in the story. So The Onion's been around for 10 years or so. This is a little bit of a description of a kind of satiric renaissance, as a scholar put it, that was taking place in the late 90s and early 2000s. So here we go. Civic or public journalism was having a renewal in the 1990s. The idea goes back at least to the 1920s and John Dewey's belief that the media should do more than just provide facts. It should also educate people how to be citizens in a democracy and play a conscious role in the community, rather than merely covering its news. At a time when potentially 70% of what you saw in the news, print or otherwise, was actually a regurgitated press release, and when even reported news and the editorial pages contained plenty of PR-generated spin funded by corporations and organizations paying people to express certain opinions, the movement was sorely needed. See, for instance, Edward S. Herman and Noam Chomsky's classic 1988 book, Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media, which shows that, contrary to the popular idea of journalists as the voice of the people, most professional journalism was simply promoting the worldview of dominant, privileged groups and institutions. The 1990s alt-weekly movement was a part of the new civic journalism, especially since many mainstream newspapers didn't want or know how to change their models, such as the requirement to discuss both sides of an issue if you were going to be objective, a method that not only is overly dualistic, but has also been exploited by questionable actors for decades to cast doubt on settled problems, such as the dangers of smoking and the causes of climate change. Just going to pause here for a moment. So the next part, I talk about being the editor of The Stranger, Seattle's alt weekly, which I did after The Onion. A lot of people don't know that the first year of The Stranger in Seattle was actually staffed by basically the people who did the first year of The Onion. So it was sort of this squad of people moved from Madison to Seattle and started Seattle's alt weekly. Anyway, so one of the things that about being an alt-weekly editor is the concept of objectivity is something that we all sort of questioned. So as the former editor of the alt-weekly The Stranger for a short but important time in the early 90s, I'm reading now if you can't tell, I had a couple of different principles behind my work. We were not objective and we didn't pretend to be. Objectivity was a made-up thing that worked primarily to sustain an increasingly useless, even dangerous status quo. We were also, however, factual and accurate as much as possible. Thinking objectivity had problems did not mean that our writers didn't do research and support their work with interviews and digging. The Onion was doing this as well at this time, just with satire, which was also gaining prevalence. Carol Kolb was a Madison student who became a really important editor and writer at The Onion at this time. She said, "You ask why news satire became so popular in the 90s and the aughts, and I believe it is because at that point news was still an authority figure and it was held in more esteem until then. I think that curtain hadn't been pulled away yet so much, and as it started to become more and more commercialized and people started to notice, it started to cheapen. People started to get more savvy and notice little things, and they stopped taking news sources as so much of an authority. So there was this desire to, like, take them down. It was one of the last remaining institutions that people hadn't really been questioning. And then they started to question it. And I think part of the reason is that it started to get more dispersed and less reliable and more influenced by commercialism. The news was not a sacred cow, but an esteemed cow. It was time for it to tumble, you know what I mean? It was time to examine the news." Amber Day, a scholar of new satire, told me that a satiric renaissance was going on in the 1990s and 2000s with many new and biting forms. There's nothing new about satire, she said. It's been around forever. But there was clearly something about the way it was developing at that moment, and it led me to look at satire as a reaction to flaws in political debate. This satire included not only The Onion, The Daily Show, and The Colbert Report, but also people like filmmaker Michael Moore and street theater culture jamming performance protest groups like Billionaires for Bush and The Yes Men. Day continued. The PR machine had gotten so good, right? The PR machine around everybody, around corporations, around politicians. People had figured out how to play the system, how to perform, how to be very media savvy. The PR industry had exploded at the same time it felt like the press had not quite figured out how to keep up. Obviously, there were still journalists doing amazing work, but news, particularly cable news, where people were getting a lot of their news, was doing a particularly poor job of being able to cut through some of the staging of our public discourse, and was in fact aiding and abetting that staging rather than actually giving people a look into how it was being produced. So, as she puts it, she uses the metaphor of pulling back the curtain for what satire at the time was doing. It was saying, hey, look at the fact that these talking points are being repeated on 30 different television stations at the same time. And nobody else was pointing that out. Nobody was saying, where do you think those talking points came from? Instead, the press was just happily repeating those talking points. And that's where satire was coming in. It was filling this void. So, The Onion's editor in the 1990s, very important editor, a guy named Rob Siegel, was really instrumental in getting The Onion into the sort of full AP news satire form at that time. And he remembers this being kind of a pivotal moment in The Onion's history. And so I'm going to read like a little quote from him and then a little comment that I made, and then I will stop. So Siegel said, I don't know that anybody else thinks of this as some watershed moment. He talks about a thing that The Onion did with a story about a bumper sticker ends abortion debate story. He said, let's use this platform to say things and let's have opinions, actual stances on things. That moment was, for me, the birth of looking at The Onion as political satire. There's nothing stopping us from speaking our minds through this device, this strange format we've created. Once we did that, it was like, oh, this opens up the entire world. Suddenly, we had this lens, this way of processing and reacting. At that point, the paper became something that could last forever because it became a medium through which one can tell jokes about and engage in the world. Satire, in other words, is one of the few rhetorical methods that effectively seeks out and destroys spin. This is why people started saying that The Onion was the only source of truth in journalism. End of my little bit there.
No, that's great. Thank you for reading that section because I think it hits on so many things that I'm going to want to end up talking about eventually,
okay.
For sure.
Excellent.
And providing that context, which is really great. I'm sure most of our listeners do not need to be told this and that there is a, you know, it's not a Venn diagram. It's a circle of people who listen to Wart and know what The Onion is. But just for the sake of maybe, you know, just making sure everybody is, you know, coming to this at the same level, what is The Onion and what was the idea behind it?
Well, the first year of The Onion was basically a way for founder Tim Keck to make some money just so he could finish up the rest of his school. But the interesting thing is that Tim actually came from a newspaper family, a Chicago area newspaper family. And he'd grown up with newspapers everywhere. Everybody, his dad was an editor. His mom was an investigative reporter. There were just reporters hanging around his house socially all the time. And he was just really soaking in the newspaper environment. So, short version is that when he needed to make some money, when he was like a junior in college here in Madison, he was like, well, maybe I'll start a newspaper. And I describe about all the other newspapers that are around. But what The Onion became was a news satire. And the way it did that was by very, like, incredible dedication to the form of the way the news. And remember, it also started as a newspaper satire, right? So, like, later on, it's funny now because sometimes I talk to younger people and they don't know that The Onion used to be a newspaper, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, and it's interesting because the satire has changed. I mean, The Onion's been around almost 40 years now, right? So Anyway, I'm getting a little off track here, but like The Onion did start out as a paper, newspaper satire. So you had to know what newspapers were and that kind of genre. And although there's like a silly side of The Onion, but then there's a more like a sharp satirical side of The Onion. And so the 90s are when they kind of developed that. And then when The Onion really exploded and became super famous was when it went on the internet in 1996. So it was one of the first comedy sites on the internet. And then it suddenly went from being totally obscure and kind of underground to like all of a sudden hundreds of thousands of people were going on the website. So and it happened like almost immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's funny to think, because I had no idea that, you know, the paper itself was born out of, you know, a tradition of like a family tradition of somebody who grew up around newspapers.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think when you look at The Onion, especially, you know, if you can find, I know they used to maybe they still do those yearly compendiums of you know, the issues and things like that, and just how much oddly love and, you know, respect almost for that newspaper form exists in it. And I think that probably comes from what you're talking about, you know, coming from a background of newspaper people who wrote for it, who did investigative reporting for it.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what is part of what makes it so special. So the book opens at UW-Madison in the late 80s when you started as a freshman coming from Spring Green.
Mm-hmm.
So just to do a little maybe walk down memory lane for many of our listeners, I'm sure, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about just what the city was like back then, what it was like to be on campus in that moment, and why you think Madison in particular was just sort of a ripe place for something like The Onion to begin.
Yeah. So Madison was, you know, as I describe in the book, it was a really great place for creative young people at that time. You could, you know, rents were still fairly cheap. You could have a minimum wage job and still have time for projects and a social life. And so there was a really great music scene at the time. There was other kinds of performance and interesting things happening. And then there was also a lot of journalism and writing and zines and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of, you know, someone like me who was coming from, you know, rural Wisconsin, it was also like, wow, you know, they have Indian food here.
Sure.
You know? Like, you know, Tim tells a story. He's joking, but he's like, they have this thing called burritos in Madison. It's amazing. You know? So it was also, you know, I mean, you know, Spring Green's only about 40 miles away. And it's not like, you know, I came to Madison to see movies and stuff all the time as a high school student. And my dad was a social worker for the state of Wisconsin. And he had an office on Langan Street. So I had been coming down here since I was, you know, a kid. But still, it was like, you know, I described Madison was sort of like the New York of Wisconsin, you know. And so a lot of people were coming from other parts of the state. And, you know, people had lots of, you know, pent up weirdness or, you know, energy or excitement. And then all that kind of explodes when they got here. So Madison was a fun place to be then.
Yeah, definitely. You can sense that in those early sections for sure, of just a lot of kind of progressive energy to the city. A lot of protests and student involved protests too, which, you know, obviously is still a part of the city's fabric, but certainly seems like there was sort of a heyday of it back then, and that The Onion is kind of picking up on that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, The Onion, you know, I think Pete Heise, the business manager of The Onion and co-owner for a long time, talks about how, you know, the Onion in some ways, this is kind of the only place. I mean, I don't know if that's really true. There are a lot of college towns that might have had similar vibe at the time. But, you know, everyone's super well-informed in Madison. You know, the arts and culture are really important in Madison. But I don't know, when I mentioned somewhere in the book about how I think one of the biggest differences between then and now is that, like, it was inexpensive enough that you could do like big projects, you know. I mean, I've got college age kid now, you know, and I'm like, where are you going to go and live where you'll be able to, like, you know, have the time and space to do what you want to do, because things are, you know, just life expenses are just a lot more expensive than they used to be, I think. So
yeah, absolutely. And I have to think that sort of, like you said, the ability to be able to live on a minimum wage type of job.
Yeah.
And, you know, that can give you the time. I mean, time is really sort of what you need when you're trying to work on those sorts of creative things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah,
which is also something that a lot of college students often have as well.
Yeah. So. right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe let's talk a little bit about that. You know, the early chapters are a lot of fun to read just because, you know, The Onion really was just this kind of crazy idea that a bunch of college students and some dropouts as well, they kind of came up with together. And, you know, a lot of the camaraderie and but also a lot of the, you know, kind of banging of heads together
sure,
that sometimes happens with those things. It was a lot of fun to read. But you were a copy editor for them from the start, but maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the other kind of major figures who were pivotal to publishing that first issue and how it came together.
They mean the very, 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 very first issue?
Yeah.
You know? Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah. So, founder Tim Keck and then his friend Chris Johnson were the kind of motor behind the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And an old friend of mine named Matt Cook Tim sort of credits him for kind of creating The Onion's voice. He was an improv comedian at the Arc Improv here in town, which I'm sure many people also remember. Pete Heise sold ads. A woman named Amy Ryer, she's Amy Bowles at the time, also did some writing. Deidre Buckingham did the photography. And this was like two or three years before Photoshop was invented. So people were still like putting on costumes and like posing for, and that kind of thing. So it was like a different process. So that was some of the important first year people. And then also a cartoonist named James Sturm contributed to The Onion as well. Sturm also, he became like a pretty well-known comics artist and helped found the Center for Cartoon Studies in Vermont, and then also a cartoonist named Scott Dickers, who later became an Onion owner and then an Onion editor. He contributed a bunch of cartoons in different styles, pretending to be different people that first year, too. So,
Yeah. That's so funny. You mentioned Photoshop. Some of the funniest bits of it were just the fact of technology itself and, you know, having just the like one computer that
to
work on. If you're all trying to meet a deadline, can probably make things a little difficult. But
a lot of people like kind of hanging around the office, like waiting for your turn in line to type on the computer. You know, it's like, I also want to mention Johanna Wilder, who was the computer person at the time and was pretty much like one of, 10 people in Madison who probably knew how to do desktop publishing, which was brand new.
Right.
Johanna was really important at this time also.
Yeah. And another thing was advertising, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That was something that you kind of had some local businesses that you were relying on to sort of buy ads. And then I think you would also kind of make up your own ads as well.
Oh, yeah, that came later on. That was after I was gone. So after the first year of The Onion, Tim and Chris sold The Onion to Scott Dickers, Pete Heise, and Johanna Wilder, who was known as Jonathan Hart Eddy at that time. And then they became the new owners of The Onion. And then it was a year or two after that, later that year, Rich Dom became then an Onion editor. Rich Dom would go on to become an executive producer of The Colbert Report and like that sort of thing. But Rich hired some of the key staff of The Onion who would become legendary later on. And Rich is an old friend of mine. So I was like, we're like hanging out with Rich at the time. but I personally had nothing to do with The Onion becoming famous, but I did know some of the people. So, yeah.
But you were there at the start.
I was there at the start. Yeah. I was literally like, Tim was like my roommate at the time.
Right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Madison BookBeat. I'm your host, Sarah Backe, and I'm here with Christine Wentz talking about Funny Because It's True. So many of the founders, including yourself, are from Wisconsin, or some are also sort of from the Chicago suburbs.
Yeah.
So do you think there's something particularly Midwestern about the voice and tone that you created for The Onion?
Yeah. I think I should say that I'm not a founder of The Onion. Yeah. Like, that was like, we call it Tim and Chris founded The Onion. The rest of us, they were just like, hey, do you want to work in this paper? Okay. You know,
sure.
You know, we were like 19. Anyway, so yeah, the Midwestern perspective, I think, is actually really important. There's a couple different ways that comes out in The Onion, I think. One is that The Onion, you know, to this day, there's no bylines. The Onion is anonymous, right? And so, although early on, there was some experimenting with bylines and made up, you know, author names and stuff at the beginning. But the sort of, I don't know, the modesty of that, or like the sort of not seeking attention part of that, I think is really Midwestern. The Onion also, you know, I think to me, The Onion took the voice of, like, you know, so ordinary area men and area women. You know, I think this is a time when you know, local news is starting to go away. And I realized at one point, like, oh, The Onion, in a weird way, especially mid-90s, early 2000s, it's like the voice of area men and area women. But when that was kind of going away, you know, and other kinds of media, you know, like local media is disappearing. And I think that the other thing that a lot of the because a lot of people are from rural Wisconsin and had read, like, their local newspapers, you know, which had their ups and downs. And so some of the early like columns in The Onion and the kinds of things they were satirizing were the sort of things that people would remembered from, like, their hometown, you know, small town newspapers. And they would be satirizing that. So as you know, writer Maria Schneider mentions, you know, you don't really see that in the Harvard Lampoon. You know, it's like a different group of people who are doing, you know, the comedy. And so it's what you're writing about is reflecting, you know, what you understand and what you've grown up with. And I think that's one of the things that made The Onion unique, actually, was coming from a very Midwestern point of view, and not like a coastal elite point of view, but a Midwestern point of view.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, something you mentioned as sort of a recurring theme throughout the book is sort of that trickster. Figure.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's sort of its popularity and kind of the folklore traditions of the Midwest, too, which I think there's definitely that energy.
Yeah.
In The Onion as well.
Yeah.
So one thing that feels very prescient to how the media works now is that kind of constant push and pull between the more corporate side of actually running a newspaper and the kind of more anarchist spirit that The Onion kind of has, particularly, as you mentioned, once it starts growing in popularity and once, you know, there are things like it going up on the internet. So can you talk a bit about what it was like to sort of work within that tension?
Yeah, The Onion, very interestingly, was basically almost like a small local business, you know, that and yet what they were making was getting a lot of national attention. When The Onion moved its editorial office from New York from Madison to New York in 2001, and not long after that, I mean, New York is a completely different market. It costs a fortune to be there. The Onion was actually had other sort of branch offices in, like, Boulder and Denver and Minneapolis and Chicago, and they moved on to a bunch of different places around that time. But Pete Heise, you know, just couldn't. The Onion was changing, and you couldn't really run it like a small local business anymore. It was getting too big and it was just difficult to do that in New York. So he ended up, first Scott Dickers sold part of his shares to an investor named David Schaefer. And then a couple of years later, Heise sold his. And so now, you know, the way I think about it is that The Onion went from being a small business to being an investment. To its owners. And so that really changed, like, the character of you know, just kind of what kept The Onion going. And then The Onion was also dealing with the same stuff that, like, the Real News was dealing with.
Right.
Because the Real News was also grappling with what happens, you know, when print goes away, you know, when you go online, it changes how you interact with your audience. And a lot of things were happening. And so it's just an interesting part of The Onion story that, you know, they're trying to satirize all these changes in media, but they're also, like, experiencing them at the same time. So, so that a lot of that was happening. That started around the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I imagine, you know, still happening in its own ways now, and especially as we're seeing local papers, as you were talking about, kind mm-hmm. of moving totally to an online format.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember getting like physical copies of the paper at our house every morning when I was younger. And yeah. now my parents read it online. And
right.
Yeah, that exact same thing is happening with satirical,
yeah.
you know, satirical entities is interesting. And it kind of probably lends a lot of the humor, a bit of authenticity as well. You know, they know of which they
speak. It's funny because this was a section of the Onion's history that I knew absolutely nothing about when I started this mm-hmm. project. And I learned that the Onion often is satirizing like what it's experiencing yeah. like in real life, right? So around, I think it was around 2016, that's when the Onion, I mean, David Schaefer decided to retire, and then the Onion started getting these like sort of big corporate owners, right? So they were bought by Univision, and then they were bought by a PE private equity firm bought mm-hmm. them after that, mm-hmm. and then you know, the kind of place that just sort of slices and dices everything; it doesn't really care like what yeah. it is. But in 2024, the Onion was sold again to people who actually want to try to save it and rescue it. Mm-hmm. And so now the Onion's owner is an entity called Global Tetrahedron, which is named after a joke in their first book, Our Dumb Century, written by Todd Hanson. Todd Hanson is another old 90s writer who is like kind of an Onion legend. And they're in a different space now. So they've brought the print edition back, which had gone away in 2013, they brought that back again, and they're kind of letting the Onion, you know, be free and be creative again. And mm-hmm. you know, they were in a phase of being sort of stuck in kind of content mill hell yeah. for a while there, and now they're trying, you know, escaping that, I hope.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah,
which is nice to hear, because a yeah. lot of places it's kind of the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
Issue.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, so kind of speaking of how you sort of put the book together. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is culled from interviews that you've been doing mm-hmm. over the past several years.
Zillions of interviews.
Yeah. So can you just talk a little bit about what that process was like for you?
Sure.
And if there was other sort of research that you did, and mm-hmm. and just sort of how this book came together.
Yeah. So I originally conceived of the book as an oral history. And after working on that for a while, I was like, wait, this is going to be like a 10,000 page book if I do that. Like, trying to do an oral history of like 36 years seemed like, this is insane. What am I doing? So, and now, plus there were also things I wanted to say and like stuff I wanted to get in there so it turned into a prose history. Mm. But yeah, I interviewed, I don't even know how many hundreds of hours of interviews I did. And it was interesting for me because there was, when I started this project, there was still a part of my brain that thought of the Onion as like, this is this funny thing my friends made in college, you know, and I knew that it was still around and I knew that it had been influential, but I didn't actually really know at all, like just how influential it was and how in the extremely high regard it's held by the comedy world and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. I really didn't know any of that stuff.
Yeah.
So I learned about a lot of that. I interviewed some scholars of satire. There's a bunch of people who kind of made their careers like writing books about, you know, is The Daily Show saving democracy kind of thing, like, you know, in the 2010s. It's interesting because now they're kind of like, I guess it did.
Yeah, right.
Or, you know, or maybe it did. Like but there are some of them rethinking. But some of those folks are super interesting because, I mean, I did graduate work in history. So I sort of know how to kind of think that way and talk to academic people. I mean, my day job has been being an academic editor for a long time. So I sort of speak academic as well as kind of, you know, alt weekly, you know, I'm kind of mixing all that stuff together in this book. But yeah, I just, you know, wrote like a monstrous draft, like putting this all together. It was like twice as long as it was supposed to be. So I cut it way down. It's always good to cut stuff. It was just super fun and fascinating to meet all these people too, you know, like I didn't, there were so many like later generation people that I had never known. And what's interesting is I didn't even know, I'm like part of the Gen X people, and there were a lot of Gen X staff, the people who kind of made the Onion what it was in the 90s, whose names I'd heard a million times, but mm-hmm. I'd never actually met in
sure.
real life.
Yeah.
So it was really fun, and they had heard my name, you know, and so it was funny that this project, you know, I actually like finally met all these people that, you know, I could have met
you know, 20 years ago and didn't. So,
yeah.
But it was really fun and super fascinating in a lot of different ways. But mm-hmm. yeah, but as you can imagine, you know, a lot of these people they're hilarious, they're smart, right. you know, they're insightful. So it was really fun to talk to everybody.
Yeah, I'm sure. And it must be tempting to just sort of let them go on and,
exactly.
you know, want to hear all the stories. You know, how they maybe match up or don't align in some ways.
Right, yeah,
too.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's really fun. So, so what was it like for you just uh-huh. personally to kind of revisit this time in your life?
Yeah, it was interesting because I moved back to Madison in 2017. I'd been on the East Coast for 20 years or more. I was in New York and Boston for a long time.
Sure.
And that's kind of what made me start thinking about the book, actually. So I, you know, you come back to Madison, I'm like, oh, you know, back in, you know, back home, my home state of Wisconsin, you know, you think about your college days or whatever. And I was having all these strange deja vu, you know, experiences walking around campus. and so it just, you know, it was just interesting to reflect. In many ways, I feel like I'm almost kind of picking up threads that I dropped 25 years ago when I left, you know, which is interesting. And there are a lot of things that you know, I thought that there was stuff that it's like a cliche. You know, there were things that I thought that I needed to sort of go out in the world and find out, you know, because like being from the Midwest, like it's not good enough. Like I'm only from rural Wisconsin. You know, I have to like learn these things about the world elsewhere. And I was like, yeah, that stuff is fine. But, you know, and I learned all that stuff. And now, like, you know, I just want to come back and come home again. So that's what I did.
Yeah. So how does it sort of, I mean, as a city and, you know, as a campus, because you do work for UW as well, how does it sort of compare, would you say, with when you were here?
Well, I mean, there's more people now. There's all these, you know, giant buildings that weren't here anymore.
Yes.
I mean, just here at WORT, I was like, oh, yeah, this used to, you know, the WORT building used to be sort of the tallest building ever. And I'm like, oh, there's like giant apartment buildings here now. Like,
right.
Didn't there used to be a parking lot? Where did that go? No, it's interesting just to watch, you know, because it's, you know, I'm like, I don't know, the whole... There's it's just a good example. Like there's tons of apartment buildings going up over Madison now. And to me, like I lived in New York and Boston for 25, you know, it's like, it's completely normal to live in apartments. Like it's not like a weird and bad, you know, but kind of encountering the NIMBY stuff here has been interesting. But you know, Wisconsin or Madison is growing and changing a lot. And I think it's going to keep on growing. You know, when I first arrived here, I went to a Dane County kind of government presentation on, you know, like the impact of climate change on Dane County. And they were like, oh, yeah, there's going to be, you know, they expect like 100,000 people to be moving here, like basically climate refugees. Right. So that's a thing. You know, I think there's just going to be more and more people moving here as things change elsewhere. But I'm glad to see the BRT, you know, coming back here. The bummer was like, oh, I'm back in car land, you know?
Sure, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I was like, oh, great. Now I have to drive everywhere. But now I try to ride the bus as when I can.
Definitely. Yeah. So I guess sort of shifting over to kind of what you were talking about when you read that opening section from your book, you know, to kind of zoom out a little bit, you know, we're obviously in a very precarious moment nationally and globally, especially when it comes to where we get our information from and what sort of vetting process, if any, is, you know, getting passed through. So, and you also mentioned a little bit towards the end of the book that, you know, now right-wing media has kind of harnessed its own brand of sort of alt comedy, if we, you know, want to use that term for it.
Sure.
Especially through kind of less gatekept media, like podcasting, obviously, is a huge one.
Yeah.
So I guess, what do you think publications like The Onion can do for readers in these kinds of times?
This is always a hard question for me because what I'm thinking is that, well, you know, The Onion, you know, there's a sort of discussion toward the end of the book about how, like, does satire even work anymore, right? Like, can you know, people always talk about how, like, the real news is as insane as, you know, The Onion. And so, like, what do you do there? And,
you know, I don't know if there's a good answer to that question. I can't really give you like a pat answer. I do believe that humor is really important. I actually gained a ton of respect for satire as like a literary form when I was writing this book, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I was one of those people that was maybe a little bit dismissive, like, oh, it's just comedy, like it's not important. And now I'm like, well, actually it is important. Like it's more important than I thought, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, the new CEO of The Onion, a guy named Ben Collins, who's a former disinformation reporter at NBC, he describes, you know, one of the reasons he wanted to kind of set The Onion free again is because he says that The Onion points out, you know, BS better than anybody else out
yeah.
there. And that's, it's still really important to do that. You know, I mean, there's just so much coming at us now. You know, The Onion is certainly not the only funny place on the internet anymore, like by far, you know.
Right.
But I, you know, it's just it's old schoolness in a way, I think is actually helpful, and I'm sure I'm biased in saying that. But it's The Onion's also has like a ton of integrity, which I think is really interesting. You know, they've always had really high standards for themselves, and you know, I think all of that is important. So
yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, what you're kind of saying about that sort of journalistic integrity
yeah.
that it has is what kind of makes it so enduring. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I have Onion headlines that I remember
yeah.
seeing, you know, I mean, I think all the time about the one that's like, why did this happen again? They say in the only country where this regularly happens.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
school shootings. Yeah.
I think about that like every time something like that happens on the news. And I'm sure a lot of people kind of feel that way. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And it sort of acts as kind of a, you know, to be sincere about it, like a community point and a point where people can kind of come together and laugh about, you know, painful things. But, you know, also, you know, it's good to have those places when you feel like you're kind of going crazy, that you're like, okay, other people see this craziness and,
right,
and
exactly.
are reacting to it too.
Yeah. There's like a morale building, you know, is part of the purpose of satire, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, did satire, you know, bring down the Berlin Wall? No, but did it, you know, does it help you like, wait, I'm not the only one who thinks this thing is crazy. Like these satirists think it's crazy too. So,
right. Yeah. So, I want to ask a couple kind of general writing questions in a bit, but before we move to that, maybe you can just ask what you hope readers take away from Funny Because It's True.
Well, I mean, like the history nerd part of me, the part of me that went to grad school in history hopes that people take away like the history of media, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I like to really remind people that, you know, things don't just appear out of nowhere. Like people made them, you know, and there's a reason why things look the way they do now. And I would hope they would get a little bit of that. But I also hope that people would, I don't know which people those are, but recognize that this came from the Midwest, that it came from Wisconsin. That's really important. You know, I think even now, you know, the region gets overlooked when it comes to, you know, a lot of cultural stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I also really wanted a lot of the people who were really instrumental in the 90s, who really made The Onion what it was, that they're not forgotten. You know, like we're in our 50s now, right? And I'm like, you know, I wanted there to be some written record of like the people who did this, because most of those folks have not made any effort to, you know, get recognition or be known for what they did. And The Onion was was anonymous, you know, so I really wanted there to be like names and I guess there's a few faces in some of the images in the book that are from Onion front pages, that because people on staff are always posing for photos in the book. But I really wanted to get those names and the stuff that those folks had done like out in the world. So.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. And I think your book does a very good job of that. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Madison BookBeat. I'm your host, Sarah Batke, and I'm here with Christine Wentz. We are talking about It's Funny Because It's True. Do you remember when you started writing?
Probably around 2018. It was pre-pandemic, because I worked on it for a while before I actually got a book deal.
Yeah, right.
You know, sure. So, and the pandemic weirdly is like one of the reasons I was able to write the book.
I had an independent business, I consult
for and do research and writing for public history projects, and I have an editing business, and I, you know, I'd made my little teeny little one person business entity, you know, like a while before that. But luckily, because I had that, I was able to get things like PPP loans and like emergency, small business funding and stuff like that. And because of that, I was able to get the time and space to actually like write my book proposal and do my sample chapters and get a book deal. So in a weird way, the pandemic actually made this book possible in some ways.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I think that's might be the case for a lot of people. Yeah. So you sort of had the idea for it. Mm-hmm. How long have you kind of wanted to write this book?
Well, I mean, like I wanted to write it. Well, what first made me want to know more about the Onion's history was a particularly weird news day during the first Trump administration. Mm-hmm. But in the book, it just says Trump administration, but it was the first Trump administration. And I thought, God, I wonder what the Onion people think of this. You know, I hadn't really thought about those folks in a long time. So I was just curious about that. And then when I started Googling around a little bit, I was like, oh, wait a minute. There's a lot of stuff on the internet about the Onion's history that isn't actually all that accurate. This is weird. I need to do something about that. So that was the other reason, because I realized that, you know, the history is written by the people who wrote it down, right? Mm. And there was a lot of, you know, actually quite inaccurate information that was out there. And I was like, okay, I need to address that. So that was the other reason. So
Great. Were you a writer when you were younger?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, I've been a writer since I was a little kid. I wrote all through school, and I was the editor of my high school newspaper, and, I've been doing that since forever. So, yeah.
Yeah. When did you kind of start thinking about it as sort of a maybe potential career path?
Oh, I'm sure it was like, you know, high school or, you know, middle school, like that's, it's like the only thing I've ever really wanted to do. I mean, I did all kinds of arts and crafts, and I play music and I sing and I do lots of other stuff. But like writing is like that's like very deeply natural thing for me to do. So, yeah.
What do you like most about writing?
Well, you know, that flow state you get into is pretty awesome. Mm. Writing's the way I think, you know. I moved out here and I was like, boy, look at all those journals. You know, like I've got, you know, like 60 or 70 journals or something.
Oh, wow.
You know, I mean, I writing is really the way that I process stuff and the way I think and the way I figure out, you know, what I think and what I feel and all that kind of stuff. And it's just my, you know, it's just my, the easiest and most, I don't know, it's just the way that I express myself and think at the same time. So,
yeah. What do you find to be the most challenging part of writing?
I've been knocking on all the wood before I say it. That's not true. I actually had like 5 years in my late 20s when I was like massively blocked for a long time. I don't know. Like I overwrite. Like I routinely write stuff like, you know, at least two or three times as long as it needs to be. But I'm like, whatever, like it's just like my process, and I just like cut it back, you know. But the most challenging part of writing for me is like all practical level stuff, you know, finding the time, finding the space. You know, my situation has always been, you know, I've been a single parent for a long time. And it's like, I can take care of family. I can make a living. There's the three things I need to do and want to do. I want to take care of my family. I want to make a living, and I want to write. But typically I can only do two of those three things at the same time.
Right.
And so guess which one, you know, gets pushed to the back routinely. So that's why the pandemic, you know, I was like, oh, I can have some money to live on without having to like go out to the job, right? So so that actually like made it possible for me to do this. So So by far the most challenging thing for me is always practical. I mean, I've done some writing residencies, and you know, I go away for 2 weeks, and like I get more done in that 2 weeks than I do in like the entire year.
Right.
So
Yeah, yeah, it's always about time. And
yeah, no, absolutely. And someone else is making you food and, you know,
right, yeah,
cleaning up
yeah.
after you and stuff like that. So, like, yeah.
Well, so it sounds like you do a lot of kind of public history projects. Mm-hmm. And so what does that entail? Is that a lot of writing you're doing for other people? Or
It depends on the project. I mean, sometimes, like, I just did a big thing for the Johns Hopkins Department of Physics and Astronomy, which was cool. But, like, I didn't have much of a background in the history of physics, so I hired a bunch of people to do. to do a lot of that work for me. But yeah, there's like tons of research. It depends, you know, I'm trying to figure out what the themes are. And it's usually, these are always like team things and they're usually like multi-year projects. But I've played at several central roles in kind of figuring out like what the themes are and like how we're going to structure this and like, you know, kind of what the story is that we're going to tell, you know, so I've done that kind of thing.
Yeah. So would you find that it kind of bleeds into your personal writing or can you sort of separate the two out?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, no, it absolutely does. Like it all kind of interacts. And I did grad school in the history of science, which is with a focus on history of medicine. I also have a master's in creative writing. But the interesting thing about the history of science, history of medicine, that people think it's like the march of great scientists through time or something. But it's like, but that's not like what it is. It's more like the history of like how we decide what's true, you know, how we decide what's real, you know, like what's, you know, in medicine, it's like, how do we decide what's normal and what's abnormal and how does that change in different places and times and that kind of thing. So that's more what we're doing. Weirdly, like that background was actually really helpful because, you know, in the process of writing this book, you know, there's all the stuff happening in the world, things that were, you know, intersecting with my personal life occasionally. It was like, what is reality? You know, like, how do we decide what the truth is? You know, like, what is there? Is there a way to define that? You know, like, and what does that stuff, what does that mean? Mm. You know, and so those ideas were resonating, you know, with me a lot as I was working on this project.
Yeah, I bet. So what is next for you? Are you working on something new?
I have a new project that has absolutely nothing to do with comedy or anything like this, like at all. It's kind of like going back to my grad school days. I recently got a National Endowment for the Humanities grant for a project which is a history of life support technology and how it changed American death.
Wow.
Between like 1950 and 2000. So this is kind of resurrecting an old grad school project. But that'll be the next thing. And so I've been trying to think of like, what do I say with the connection between these two things? Like what? But like, you know, it's like one's about comedy, one's about tragedy, you know, but they're also both about technological systems, you know?
Sure.
And they're both, and they are in a weird way, they both are also about like, you know, how we decide what's true and real, I think. Mm-hmm. So we'll see, but. Yeah, I don't have a book deal for that one yet, but you know, I'll be putting that proposal together in the next few months, I think.
Wow. So, all right. Well, it sounds very intriguing and we'll keep our fingers crossed and hopefully be able to read that one soon.
Yeah.
I've been speaking with author Christine Wentz about her book, Funny Because It's True. Through dozens of interviews, Wentz charts The Onion's rise, its position as one of the first online humor sites, and the way it influenced television programs like The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. Funny Because It's True reveals how a group of young misfits from flyover country unintentionally created a cultural phenomenon. It is now available from Running Press. When does it actually, what's the
March 18th.
Okay, so
And then 18th. We're having there's going to be an event at Art Lit Lab it's part of the Wisconsin Book Festival on the 18th. So
okay, great. Excellent. So if you're local, you can go to that. And you can also get the book at your local bookstore or online. Christine, how can listeners find out more about you?
good question. I don't know, my LinkedIn page. I don't have a website or anything. You're just gonna have to wait for the next thing, I think.
Okay.
I like my privacy. So
yeah, no, it's a good time not to be on social media right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I am on Blue Sky, but I only tune in occasionally. So
this is probably wise. So you mentioned the event at Artlit Lab that will be on March 18th. Mm-hmm. Do you have any other events coming up that you want to plug?
Yep, there's one coming up in Milwaukee on the 20th, and there, and I'm doing some other media stuff, so you might be, I think there's might be something in the Capital Times and like other things are going to be happening. So yeah, you might hear about this in other places over the next few weeks.
Yeah, it'll be around. All right, great. Well, you've been listening to Madison BookBeat. I'm your host, Sarah Batke. Join me next time when I will be a week earlier on April 7th. Thank you to Andrew Thomas for running the soundboard today, to News Director Sholly Pittman, to Christine for joining us today, and to you for listening. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Coming up next is a three-hour set of all-around jazz with Alex Wilding White. But first, some announcements.
And this is 89.9 FM WORT in Madison and WORTFM.org. And as she just said, 3 hours of jazz and improvised music on All Around Jazz. That is indeed up next, right after these messages.
We would like to thank the following local restaurants and businesses who provided meals for our hardworking volunteers during our recent fall pledge drive. Bandung, Bonzo, Cardinal Bar, Cooper's Tavern, Einstein's Coffee and Bagels, Epic Mortgage Lending, Festival Foods, Glass Nickel Pizza West, Hong Kong Cafe, Ian's Pizza, Just Veggies, Lao Lang Zan, Mickey's Tavern, Melio's on MLK, Original Pancake House on University Avenue, Pizza Bruta, Soups I Did It Again in Spring Green, Teddy Wedgers, Weary Traveler, Wilma's Fund LGBT Assistance, and the Willie Street Co-op. WORT would like to extend our gratitude to these restaurants for helping put the community in WORT Community Radio through their donations of food. Gratefully yours for nearly five decades, this is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services, serving area businesses, nonprofits, and multi-dwelling properties with high-speed, net-neutral internet, digital phone, and television services. On the web at restechservices.net or by phone at 608-663-3868.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 10th.
What a hoot to see so many once cocky big boss men of corporate America completely surrender their policies, principles, and personal pride to grovel at the feet of Trump. Even egomaniacal tech billionaires like Musk, Bezos, and Zuckerberg are publicly debasing themselves with a cringy eagerness to kiss up to the Donald. Indeed, CEOs in practically every industry, from oil to food, have suddenly converted to MAGA nuttiness. And to prove their devotion, each is loudly pledging to sacrifice all of their corporate programs that advance such core American values as equal rights, workplace fairness, and environmental protection. Parroting Trump's decree that DEI egalitarianism is immoral, the barons piously insist that their reversal is a matter of ethics. Hogwash. Their morality starts and ends with money, and as the Bible points out, the love of money is the